Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel for this Tuesday, the 5th of August. It's wonderful to have you with us. Let me introduce our panel to you. And before I do that, just remind you that you can join in on our conversation roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We have a full house this morning. Let me introduce everybody to you. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Yo.
Yo. Political consultant Libby Post is with us. Good
morning,
Libby. Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is in the house.
Yahoo.
And our dear friend visiting from the wilds of Washington, D.C., a former WAMC commentator, a professor of public policy and Africana studies at the University at Albany, and our dear, dear friend Helen DeFossis is with us.
So glad to be here, really.
It's so nice that you're visiting and can do this in the meantime. Thank you very much. It's great to have your voice on our airwaves again.
Thank you. Very, very good to be here.
All right. So let us talk about what's going on in the news. Again, we welcome you. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll begin with what is happening in the world and certainly a topic that that Helen knows an awful lot about, and that is Africa. We talked about Ebola yesterday, and certainly much more in the news. Today, President Obama is turning his attention to Africa this week. He is aiming to demonstrate a sense of command as he presides over meetings with nearly 50 African heads of state in Washington. His aides say he will discuss issues including ways to help the economies of African countries, increase trade, strengthen democracy, and enhance regional security. But meanwhile, crises are flaring in many places around the world, and Americans increasingly dissatisfied with the president's handling of foreign policy. So it is unlikely that a new emphasis on Africa will change negative perceptions of Obama as a world leader. Helen, what do you think?
Well, I think some good things could come out of this. This is the first ever leadership summit in Washington of 50, 51 African leaders from all over the continent. Also, the president is going to be very, very careful not to commit the United States to huge outlays of funds or security involvement, but rather he's bringing in executives like Jeffrey Immelt from GE, people from all over the country to talk about what kinds of investment opportunities there are for Africa. So the idea is, how can the U.S. have a positive presence in Africa, but at the same time not incur any huge commitment expenses? And I think this way of approaching it, which is a partnership with the private sector, could have some real benefits. Africa, some of those countries are some of the few growth economies in the world right now, and people don't know that about Africa.
Alan, what do you think?
Well, two things. Number one, there's the concept of, you know, helping a lot of these guys who are African strongmen. We all know it. Basically dictators. And, does the United States, which is always preaching democracy, help itself when it does that? Number two, the motivation for why we're doing it. You know, I was listening to BBC very early this morning, and there was some notice of China, the specter of China, which is doing very well in Africa right now. They've devoted tremendous resources to business and everything else there. And so, like so many other times, are we doing this in order to just sort of counter the Chinese effort? And is it too late? I hope not.
Well, you're making an excellent point, as usual, Alan. China's been right in there ever since the Cold War collapsed, back in 1989-90, and the Soviets left. And China got right in there. And what they want is resources. And what they want is payoff for their economy from investing in these incredible resources like mines and facilities like that all over Africa. I don't think the U.S. could ever compete with them on that basis in terms of any cost that we want to incur. It's very interesting. The polls are showing that Americans could care less about foreign policy right now in terms of an election issue. As you know, where this is the midterm election 2014.
Have we ever been good on that, though?
Huh?
Have we ever been good on that?
We've not been good on it in the past, but usually, you know, our leaders would talk to us about it. Of course, President Obama really has no good news to talk about in the foreign sphere right now. And that's, as Alan says, bringing down his entire approval rating. I mean, the economy's in pretty good shape. He should be getting more credit. But the foreign policy sphere is a mess.
And in most of that, he inherited.
Yeah, but some of them, you know, it's Syria, Egypt, Malaysia, Ukraine. It all looks terrible. And unfortunately, when it's on your watch, you get the blame. So it's a bad time.
Right, you are, Helen. It really, you know, you can point back to the Bushes and all the rest. But in the end, you're evaluated on what's going on your watch. And I think on the foreign policy thing, there's so many disasters. This business of you know, supporting the, quote, democratic movements in the Arab Spring, for example, turns out to have once again bitten us right in the posterior. These people aren't anything. The people who are leading some of these things are anything but democracies. And as a result, we are training the next generation of Osama bin Laden's over there. We really have to do better thinking. You know, I expect that the people who are in the foreign policy area are the experts, and that what am I? But it does seem to me, and did from the very beginning, and listeners to this program know, that I expressed some real reservations about this very subject. So you got to think it out.
Well, and we're not letting the worst strongmen even come to this summit. Like, for example, we're not letting Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe come. He's one of the worst strongmen, and we're not even
letting
him come.
That invitation got lost.
Yeah. But Alan is right. I mean, the point is, when you try to teach democracy, what are you trying to teach, and how much does it cost to teach it, and how much dissension are you going to tolerate in that process?
Well, one of the unrecognized issues in all of this, where you have these Fortune 500 companies getting involved in this, is the policies in Africa around lesbian and gay people. And you have Uganda, who passed a law making homosexuality illegal. The courts just overturned it on a technicality because, they didn't have a quorum to be able to pass the bill. But you have all these Fortune 500 companies that are scoring very, very high on the Human Rights Campaign Corporate Index. And then they're going to go do business with countries that score really, really low in anyone's perspective on lesbian and gay, bisexual, and transgender rights. And so it's going to be interesting, the balancing act that these corporations and the administration is going to have to play, because when this comes back, and next year HRC does its next corporate index and GE is doing business, because we saw it in the TU today's with Algeria, right?
Right now with Algeria, but they're planning to double the number of people they have over there and invest a couple billion.
What's going to happen?
And hopefully they'll even pay their taxes here.
That would be nice. But the question remains,
that was a shot.
Yeah, will these corporate relationships be able to leverage better human rights?
Well, two pieces of good news on after that, you know, really
diatribe.
Piece of bad news. Right. No, that is bad news out of Uganda. But the United States really came down on Uganda as a result of passing that anti-gay legislation. We began to withdraw aid from them. And this court thing that overturned that law happened on the eve of the the Ugandan president's visit to the U.S., which everyone's saying is not accidental. So they are getting the message from us, particularly in a world in which we're trying to focus on corporations being involved in our African policy. So you're absolutely right. I mean, the corporations don't want to be caught in this either.
No. It's
I mean,
not good
rather than, you know, get a repeat of what happened in South Africa in the 70s and 80s, rather, you know, where the U.S. companies were forced to pull out, they're going to be very cautious about which countries they support because they know the implications.
You know, there was a time in South Africa when corporations were making 17% per year on their investment.
Well, it's because they didn't pay anybody anything.
That's right. That's right. So anyway, the world is changing. The world is changing. And I think everybody's going to try to put the best possible face on this visit. The president wants all those leaders to be happy, but he doesn't want to make too much of a commitment.
One of the lines that struck me in some of the materials that you sent me articles on this, Helen, was that some people were questioning how much of a presence the president will have during the summit.
Yeah. A lot of these leaders are coming expecting to meet one-on-one with him.
Some FaceTime.
It's not going to happen. It's not going to. First of all, there are 51 of them and only one of him. But secondly, he's meeting with them in big groups, limited amounts of time. But President Clinton is coming.
Yeah, he's leading a panel discussion.
To lead a panel discussion, you know. So the idea is how to make these leaders feel that they've really been treated royally while at the same time not overcommit the U.S.
Alan, do you think the issue of Ebola and the concerns, will that be an elephant in the room?
No, I think that is an elephant in the room, obviously, and I'm fascinated. I don't want to get into the whole Ebola thing again. How quickly we're being told that there are ways out of this, ways to protect ourselves, new antiviral things, new ways of which didn't. I mean, we weren't hearing about them when the problem was African. And now that a couple of people have come back to the United States, we're hearing from some of our most prestigious medical institutions that it isn't as bad as we had thought it was. That's fascinating. I also think the other elephant in the room may be the first African-American president doing something about Africa. And he doesn't want to overplay that, obviously, but it's going to be part of his heritage, and I'm sure it's much on his mind.
Yeah,
Helen, you
and you
right?
know, this midterm election coming up, what the Democrats need is for people of color to turn out. They need women to turn out, and they need the LGBT community to turn out. And they do not necessarily turn out in as large numbers as they do in a regular election year. Those midterm elections, women, even women who always go to the polls, stay home in greater numbers in a midterm election year, as do African Americans. So this might help to generate a little more enthusiasm about getting them out to vote.
Libby, thoughts on that?
Well, I think that there's dangerous waters ahead in terms of the midterm elections. Everyone is saying that it looks like there's 60% chance that the Republicans can take the Senate. I read this morning there's still some competitive races, but this falls right into what we were talking about yesterday in terms of, yes, the Republican Party is alienating anybody but white men, but it's the white men who come out to vote.
That's right. That's right.
and it's more white people that come out to vote. And so, I think the LGBT community, we vote, you know, midterm or not, because we know it's our lives. But it's similar to primaries. You know, it's only the diehards who really come out and vote in the midterm elections because it's not the president. And I hate Congress, but I love my congressman. I mean, it's all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the sense of resignation of it's corrupt. There's nothing we can do about it. So why bother?
Well, and this is the first year, I think, that more people are saying, I don't like my congressman, than has ever occurred in the past. Because you're absolutely right. People will always say, I don't like the institution, but I love so-and-so. This year, they're not saying that. 54% are not saying that.
Yeah. I think that's all true. Libby, you said something that I'm always fascinated by when you'd say the LGBT community comes out. What percentage of the American electorate do you think that group is?
I think probably 10%, 7 to 10% of the electorate would be a good ballpark number, because we're between 7 to 10% of the population, and I think that our community is much more politically aware and much more politicized. This isn't to say that not everybody is really a political activist, because that's not the case, but they recognize voting has a direct impact on our lives, because it's the people we vote into office that make the laws that impact us.
So if that's the case, let's bring it back to what Helen said earlier about getting other people out who traditionally don't vote in the same numbers. For example, Hispanics or blacks. In midterm elections. Although, Helen, to be fair, in any elections. In other words, you may get a larger group, which we did in the last presidential election. A black candidate was running and all the rest, but it still is far below what the white demographic looks like in elections.
Right, and look at the Republicans. I mean, they're torn between trying to get the Latino vote.
Torn between two lovers.
And yet...
Well, that paints a picture, doesn't it?
It does. Now I'm speechless.
Well, Helen, where have you seen them really trying to get the Latino?
Well, I'm saying that they all know they shouldn't. Like Libby was saying, they can't just turn out the white male vote. But on the other hand, they don't want to do anything on immigration. So here they are.
I am sensing
because they don't want to lose primaries.
That's right.
I am sensing we can discuss this issue more. So let's take a break. We'll go and do all of our business, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about midterm elections and other issues. We welcome your comments as always. Roundtable@WAMC.org, roundtable@WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Helen DeFosses, Libby Post, and we welcome your comments. Roundtable@WAMC.org after this short break. Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel this morning. Let me reintroduce the panel to you. WAMC's Alan Chartok joins us. Good morning, Alan.
Yo.
And political consultant Libby Post is here.
Yes.
Good morning, Libby. Mike Spain, associate editor of the Times Union. And Helen DeFosses is in town. You know, Helen was a longtime professor here in Albany, and then, of course, was on the Albany Common Council for years, and a longtime WAMC commentator. And then she up and left us and went to the Washington, D.C. area. And now you're teaching at George Mason University.
Yeah, they have a lifelong learning institute, and I teach public policy there. And I just finished teaching a course on the midterm elections.
So there's less than 100 days before the midterm elections.
Well, I'm embarrassed to say that I ran counter to my normal practice, and that is I finished the course with a prediction. And I try not to ever do that, but I got carried away on the last class. And I said that I thought the Democrats would retain control of the Senate coming out of the midterm elections. And my reasoning was that all that brouhaha over the Affordable Care Act and the terrible rollout and all of that would have died down by then, and that people would be willing to think about the fact that the economy was strengthening and times would be good for the Democrats. However, now that I'm looking at what's happening with the various elections that are taking place around the country in a primary sense, and also with polling that's going on, it looks like the Democrats will not retain control of the Senate, or if they do, it's going to be by maybe one vote. I mean, this is going to be so tight and so close.
So I want to talk about this. Alan, I know you have a couple of letters. Let's go to those, and then we'll get into the subject as a whole.
Okay, because I'd like to say something about that, too.
Yes.
Okay, our very wonderful Jeannie Hunter has checked in. Back in the late 70s, the Chinese government had built a railroad across Tanzania, previously a German colony. In a gift shop in the capital, only Chinese soaps, toiletries, toothbrushes were available, and I understand that the railroad was built by Chinese workers. President Obama's initiative summit is commendable, but we are late in coming to the table. But I'd like to react to that and say that if you go into any place in America, Chinese soaps, toiletries, toothbrushes are available.
And railroads were probably built by the Chinese.
Well, and they built the railroad.
That's correct, Mike.
In the West. Yeah.
They built railroad in the good old days of the Cold War, too. You know, when they were, there was a triangle of the U.S. and Russia and China. And China built that Trans-Am Railroad, they called it. And then they were sort of quiescent for a long period of time. But as I said earlier, once the Soviets left in 1989, boy, they've been in there with a vengeance. And if you go to Central Asia, the Chinese are buying up. They want energy resources. That's what they really are worried about. And they are buying up energy and minerals all over the world. While we're fighting ourselves and our parties can't agree on anything, the Chinese are just going right ahead with the checkbook politics.
And Matt Mann, one of our regulars, checks in and says, interesting piece, NPR not too long ago, huge investment from them and not the conflicts slash fictions, but tech food stuff and tourism futures for them. And a steak dinner in D.C., Afro-themed dessert is fudge cake with vanilla from Madagascar. Okay, make of that what you will.
All right.
How
so
unfortunate.
Now, Alan, you wanted to Helen was talking about midterms, and you want to comment on that.
I do. You know, here's the deal. There is one thing. Helen and I, of course, are political scientists. We watch in Great Britain as there is a, you know, there are these, or Israel, where there are these national elections, and parties win. We have a system here, and that's what Helen was talking about when she said she looks at the individual races. See, I've always thought that an intelligent, well-positioned president and his people, Bill Clinton, for example, go out and say at the top of their voices, if you want all the things that Helen was talking about, if you want decent health care, if you want decent education, then you really have to vote Democratic or, in the case of the Republicans, vote Republican. In other words, the nationalization, and I think it takes a strong leadership to do that, and our political leaders just don't do it. They'll go support individual races, fly around the country and do that, but they don't make the argument. They don't rent a half an hour from the networks and say, okay, this is all about, we have to be together on this.
Yeah, and you know, another interesting point there, Alan, poor President Obama, while all these crises have been occurring in Gaza and the Ukraine and whatever, my Republican friends say to me, what's he doing? He's running around the country having fundraising dinners. Well, he's not running around having fundraising dinners for himself. He's trying to make sure that these individual Democratic candidates are going to get reelected and therefore the Democratic Party will be strong. But it does make him look, unfortunately, in the meantime, as if he's eating foie gras and fudge cake with Madagascar vanilla ice cream or something while everyone else is suffering. And it's hard to be a party leader.
That didn't even sound good.
And what you mean, the Republican leaders don't run around and eat the same stuff?
Well, I mean,
it's all about money.
But, they're all piling on to the president, right, for being absent from the White House while these terrible crises are occurring. And
you know, let's do a side-by-side comparison of the vacation days, and we'll see who took more vacation. It was George Bush, you know. Who was in Crawford more?
I think after 6 years in office, that's not on people's minds. And what's interesting about what Helen said was that you know, he's raising all this money, and they say that $2 billion will be spent in midterm election advertising.
There's already more. I think 200,000 ads have already aired.
Yeah,
it's just really incredible. Something. If you visit, I mean, are there any in the Washington D.C. area? Are you seeing it all over TV?
Virginia is always a swing state and all of this stuff, and we are just inundated.
Yeah, you can't turn on the TV and not get one right after another.
Although I did see that one Cuomo ad up here.
About New York.
Oh, no, you would see a lot more than one.
Right. And I've only
Startup New York.
I've only seen one where he's
attacking. Those are political ads? I thought those were promoting New York State.
The Astorino
Christmas in July.
I did see that. Yeah, his Christmas present was called Moreland Act.
Right.
right.
Nicely put. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up our conversation today. And we have we're getting through a lot. You guys are great. We'll talk more when we come back. Not keeping you up, am I, Libby?
No.
Okay.
Please, you have no idea.
We'll be back. Let Libby take a mini nap. We'll be back in just a moment on WAMC.
Support for WAMC is in PS21, Performance Spaces for the 21st Century, Chatham, New York, presenting the PS21 Dance and Dancemakers Film Festival. 5 films through Saturday, August 9th, nightly at 8 p.m., ps21chatham.org. Brattleboro Retreat, offering an LGBT inpatient program providing mental health and addiction services for LGBT adults. BrattleboroRetreat.org. And the Henyon Bakery Emmer, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole-grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com.
Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel for this Tuesday morning, the 5th of August. Once again, WAMC's Alan Chartok is here, political consultant Libby Post, Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, and our dear friend and commentator Helen DeFossis joins us. And we welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. One of the other big issue I wanted to get to, which I thought was a fascinating article in the New York Times published yesterday, justices' rulings advance gays, women less so. When Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg reflects on the Supreme Court's recent rulings, she sees an inconsistency in its gay rights rulings. She told a law school audience last week, the court uses the soaring language of equal dignity and has endorsed the fundamental values of liberty and equality. Indeed, a court that just 3 decades ago allowed criminal prosecutions for gay sex now speaks with sympathy for gay families and seems on the cusp of embracing a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. But in cases involving gender, she said, the court has never fully embraced, quote, the ability of women to decide for themselves what their destiny will be, end quote. She said the court's 5-justice conservative majority, all men, did not understand the challenges women face in achieving authentic equality.
You know what this reminds me of? There's that famous sociologist, Rosabeth Moss Kanter at Yale, who writes about men and women in the corporation. And she talks about what happens to the X's when the first O appears. So all the men really aren't too aware of themselves as men until the first woman comes. Well, now we have 4 women, right, on the court? Three women on the court.
We're at 4. Wishful thinking. Things would be a lot different.
Right. Wishful yes. thinking. I'm sorry. Wishful thinking. But 3 women on the court who've begun to act together.
Yeah.
And that's really a phenomenal thing. That's a real change, particularly around this issue where, frankly, women around the country are not acting together.
Well, I also think, you know, this, so the Supreme Court has sort of mirrored, in a sense, what's going on in the country. I remember, you know, anti-choice, the 80s, choice was, reproductive rights was virulent. You had people who were horribly anti-choice. And then the gay rights stuff started to bubble up. And the choice stuff went to the wayside by the radical Christian right because they really focused on the gays. Because we're the sinners and we're horrible people and blah, blah, blah. And they're losing that argument, so they're revisiting their old chestnut, which is women's rights.
Yeah.
And I do think the gender issue here on the Supreme Court, you have 4 white guys, period, end of story. Old white guys.
In fact,
old white Republican guys, basically.
Yes, thank you for that clarification.
I saw some election results in one of the primaries. I can't remember where it was for the 2014 elections. And the winning candidate said something about, we didn't think white men were getting enough attention, yes, policy-wise.
White men's movement.
And I thought, wow, you know, this is really an amazing thing to say, you know, at a time when in politics and law, it's beginning to look like a lot of white men's issues are getting attention, and that the Republican Party could still collapse if they don't deal with that issue.
Well, I just want to make one point, Alan. Do the white men want the government to tell them what to do with their bodies? Women have to deal with the government telling us what to do with our bodies all the time, but there are no laws passed around what men should do.
Can Mike and I come back in like 9 minutes?
Yeah, sure. How do you feel about that, guys?
Yeah, right. I know you all are secure enough in your masculinity not to be threatened.
No. Alan, go ahead.
But yesterday we talked about this wonderful article about the professor from California who said that in the interim of between what Helen says is inevitable, and it is, when Hispanics vote in the numbers that they have proportions and people who are black do the same thing, in the interim, the white guys will be circling the wagons, mm-hmm, and will win elections because they are so threatened at this point that everybody will turn out. And that's the kind of thing we're seeing right now. And that's why, Helen, your candidate, while remarkable, who says, you know, white guys aren't getting enough, that's a technique to mobilize the forces.
Yes. And one thing we haven't talked about this morning is the incredible efforts going on in many states to restrict people's
access to voting
and the ballot.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's been very, very serious in some states where people are going to have to travel 60 miles or something in order to get a new photo ID. In Virginia now, you're not going to be able to vote unless you have a current photo ID. And that means that a lot of people, you know, are not going to be able to vote even in the November elections, going into effect right away. They're not going to be able to vote in the November elections, even in state, you know, like U.S. Senator and things
and
like
that. And it proportionately affects the poor and the powerless.
And people of color, sure, and people who are mobile. If you're mobile, you know, if you're, which has been a group that's always been suspect to both parties, because if you're a renter, how mm-hmm can we really count on you?
Right? You don't pay property taxes.
You don't pay property taxes.
How can you vote?
Yes, and how do we know how you're going to vote? How are we going to predict that?
So this is a throwback, you know, to times when, you know, prospective voters had to recite the Constitution, you know, and come in. And those were all declared, you know, not correct. You couldn't do it. But in a way, we've replaced them. We've replaced all of the techniques that were used to disqualify voters. And the courts said, no, you can't do that. But now we're doing it.
And these four, five guys who are on the Supreme Court, if a case came across their desk, I bet you that they would vote in favor of these restrictions. Because,
well, you know, Libby, it's funny the way these. But it's funny the way they are, though. They know, they love it when they get a case that is so outrageous that they can throw it out. In the meantime, taking everything from the middle on that looks, you know, as if it's reasonable. Look, I'm telling you now, you say to people in a poll, should people be able to produce an ID in order to vote, some kind of a picture ID? You know, you'd get half or more saying absolutely.
Right. Well, they don't want any fraud at the ballot, but that isn't an issue and it's not a real problem. So it's an invented problem. How many times?
I'm not arguing for it, Mike.
I know, but I mean, I think that people are just unaware. I mean, the mainstream is unaware. I mean, we don't get asked for IDs in New York.
No.
You just go in, you sign your name, and you vote.
And if it looks like,
and then Andrew Cuomo has you disqualified. And then Andrew Cuomo has you disqualified from the ballot for having written one letter from
Vermont. Now we've moved on. You know.
Well,
Someone gave me
a book recently called The Roberts Supreme Court. You know, yes. and Supreme Robert Court Craig, yes. justices live forever. I don't know if you've noticed that. There right. must be something about the rarefied
and,
air.
And God bless Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I hope she lives Bader forever.
Ginsburg. Well, yeah, right. You know, but that's an interesting question. Yeah. Do you want her to live forever?
Well, or I want her to want live her to for step, at least 3 more years.
Well, maybe you want her to step down, though, while Obama is still president.
And do you think the Congress will ever approve any candidate that he puts?
I couldn't agree with you more, Mike.
I don't know.
You are so right.
I don't know. What kind of chances are we going to have?
It's a roll of the dice either way.
It is a roll of the dice, but as long as
I understand your
we
point.
We got a Democratic president, we got a better chance of getting a liberal nominee.
But we've just been talking for a better part of this hour about how we can't get anything done. Nobody can get anything through. Nobody can do anything. The turnover of the Senate. I mean, I understand the point of wanting to put somebody in there younger who could have a more lasting effect on the court. And from my understanding, it's something that Ginsburg has been debating in her own mind for the last 3 years.
To step down.
Yes, but doesn't think that it would come through.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, but I got bad news for you guys, and that is none of the five are in danger right now. It is the Republican guys, it's the Democratic guys who will be replaced because they're getting older. Right?
That's the problem.
Well, it's just Ruth. I mean,
Kagan isn't that old.
Yeah, Kagan's not that old, and Sotomayor's not that old.
He's young and right. writing yeah. all those books.
And you've, I mean, Alito and the other one who's
Scalia.
So wonderful, Scalia.
The other one,
getting,
Kennedy's
up there.
Yeah, they're getting up there. So,
what not are we wishing for here, there. Folks?
But the Republicans are very smart. They nominate younger people.
You know, during the last presidential election, when McCain and Obama were running against each other, we heard very, very little from either of them about the Supreme Court. I was really surprised. I thought it might become more of an issue. You should vote for me because, you know, the average age of so-and-so's on the court is getting
well,
higher.
No one wants to, like, be that clear about politicizing the court.
Well, you know? We used to talk about it in the good old days.
Yeah, well, we talk about it, but, you know, I don't think a presidential candidate would fare well to say, vote for me because I'll make sure the court is stacked.
Right, it's more subtle. You know, you'll get a pundit saying, you know, the next, you know, we'll be replacing three justices in the next 8 years. So
right,
this
the pundit who is
well,
tied.
Well, Andy wrote in and he said, Rogers is not old. And I say, who's Rogers?
Yeah, I think he meant Roberts.
Roberts.
Yeah, not Rogers.
No, Roberts is not old. No. That's my point.
I think he's under 60.
He's under 60. He's like my age. And they live forever. You know, so he
it's
could just
low
be
stress
us.
Job. You know how it is.
He could be with us for a long, long time. You know,
well, so. Hopefully all of you will be with us for a long, long time. Libby Post, Helen DeFossis, Mike Spain, Alan Chartok, thank you very, very much for being with us. And it's great to have you all together. Thank you. And we'll continue the roundtable after this short break.